I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Are you a member of a labor union? Pretty sure you're not. Since its peak a long time ago, union membership has been in a long, steady skid down. Despite the fact that a majority of workers today say they want union representation. Our guest today, Sean Richman, argues the current moment is, quote, pregnant with possibilities. His new book is titled, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. And as one reviewer put it, his book makes it clear that tweaking existing laws and trying to operate under the existing legal framework and models of unionism is a road to nowhere, but a continued slide into irrelevance for unions, end of quote. So in this new gilded age, when a tiny fraction of a percent owns so much of the nation's wealth, so much rampant and worsening inequality, what options are there for change? Well, Sean Richman spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. He's program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. His writing has been published in the American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin, New York Daily News, and the New York Times. Sean Richman, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us, please, about the reasons you wrote this book. What are the issues that are not being addressed? Why is it needed?
Well, like I say in the beginning of the book, there are plenty of books that have made the argument that this tremendous inequality that we have in this country, this crisis of democracy that we have, is intimately related in the fact that most workers don't have a union. And I'm not making... you can read those books. They're great. what I'm trying to get at is that bringing unions back is actually incredibly complicated. And it's complicated by the fact that most union leaders, most union activists, sort of want to bring back what used to exist, and that's our vision. It's like let's amend the National Labor Relations Act so that we can get back to 33% density, where union bargaining, you know, at General Motors or whatever the current equivalent of General Motors at Google carries over to the rest of the economy, and that's impossible to do. And really, the problems that we have, the reason that most workers don't have a union, is that employers have spent a half century seceding from that system by subcontracting, by offshoring, by freelancing. A lot of our employment problems in the economy are directly related to employers trying to get out of a system that bases a union on, well, whether you have a union on your specific workplace and whether a group of workers sometime in the past voted for a union, won a contract, and have somehow managed to hold on to that. And that what we really need are systems of all-in systems of labor relations, whether that is something that looks like the German Works Council model, whether that's something that looks like sort of industrial labor boards where work rules will be applied to all companies across an entire sector, whether that means a just cause right to your job, which is the thing I've been advocating. But that we have to go bigger and wider, and we have to make it a union, whether it's going to be a workplace democracy, a form of government at the workplace, not subject to an employer's veto and not subject to this sort of high stakes election where the employer has all of the power.
Workplace democracy. Boy, that does sound good. I like that idea. I've always thought that if people who make something have a stake in it and a say in it, you get better product and happier people, and it just works out better for everybody. But why, you know, unions, you know, there's the old model of us versus them. What about employee, ownership programs and having, there are worker-owned companies which are having difficulty, but sometimes they work. Anyway, what about a model like that? And what is this German Works Council model that you mentioned?
Well, so the German Works Council is it's a complicated thing, right? So if you're thinking about a system of workplace government, it needs to be at multiple levels, right? Like during the primaries, Elizabeth Warren had a very good idea of mandating more worker representation on corporate governance boards.
Yes, nice.
So at the highest sort of macro level of a company, yes, there should be worker voice. I mean, the problem with a lot of these sort of EOP type is that they're just small. I mean, they're small businesses. Uh-huh. The economy is really run by big businesses. So workers should have a seat at the table at the highest level of decision making. I've known a lot of auto workers over the years, and the frustration that auto workers have about how they're building cars that they themselves would not want to buy is massive, right? So they want to have a say in, are we going to make Hummers or are we going to make fuel efficient, mid-sized sedans? Why don't we have minivans anymore? Stuff like that. But then the Works Council is at a much more intimate level at the company. It really is on a shop floor level, that's decision making over the work schedule. When are we clocking in? When are we clocking out? It is where the level of where grievances take place and are adjudicated. Whereas what we do in America is we sort of combine government, workplace government with the political parties. A grievance process is spelled out in a contract and you only have it if you have a union. Whereas in Germany, it just exists on day one. And there are elections that take place where, workers are choosing amongst a number of potential representatives and they're joining, they get to join whatever union they want. But there's going to be a workplace government. The right wing likes to analogize these National Labor Relations Board elections, which are what determines for most people whether there's going to be a union in your workplace. They like to analogize it to a congressional election. But when we're voting for Congress in November, we're not voting for whether there's going to be a Congress. We're simply voting for who is going to represent us for the next 2 years. And that's the kind of system that we need to be getting closer to. There's going to be a workplace government. There is a workplace government in every workplace in America. Mm-hmm. It's a dictatorship in most workplaces.
Yeah, and interesting how, the German economy has long been one of the strongest. So, this is good for the general economy. And estimates suggest that almost 60% of American workers would like union representation, but fewer than 11% currently have it. Why that disparity? Is it that structure that you were talking about that, they just have one vote, like, will we be union? I don't know. Talk about that, if you would, please, Sean.
So an NLRB election, right, which is it's an all or nothing election, right? So at any given workplace, in my experience as a union organizer, in every workplace, about one third of the workers are ready. But you got to get to 70% of the workers, 80% of the workers, in order to trigger an election. Technically, you only need 30% to trigger an election. But the reality of it is, once you trigger the election, the employers will wage a scorched earth campaign, including terminating union activists, even though it's illegal, they do it. And it's going to chip away your support. So you got to start at 80 so that you maybe finish up at better than a majority went on the day of the election. But the thing about that election, too, this is an argument that I lay out repeatedly in the book, and I laid out in a white paper for the Century Foundation a number of years ago, called Labor's Bill of Rights. A National Labor Relations Board election is an election being conducted by an arm of the government to determine whether additional statutory rights are going to be applied to citizens. And the conduct of that election, the rules of that election, are such that only one party gets to force the voters into a mandatory meeting where they get to lay out their argument, and they can fire people if they don't attend the meeting, and within that meeting they can threaten people's jobs, They can lie about what's going to happen. They can hire somebody to impersonate an agent of the government. And in 10% of all elections, they do that. They just hire somebody to impersonate an agent of the election and lie about the rules of the election. And crucially, not only is that party only the employer, it's also only an employer that advocates a no vote. If an employer advocates a yes vote, that somehow is also illegal. Now, when you step back from those rules, how is that not politically coerced speech?
Yeah, really?
How is that not a massive violation of our First Amendment rights?
Wow. That's...
And I think we have to start making those kinds of arguments. And one thing that unions do a lot, I think, is we suffer in silence. I don't think most people understand just how rigged that system is.
Yeah, interesting how, you know, well, when money is at stake, you know, some people can do some bad things. And there's a long history of anti-union stuff in this country. Some of it does get pretty ugly. They certainly have used agents, spies before to mess things up. No question about that.
We have one of the bloodiest histories of labor relations in the Western world. You know, one of the good things the National Labor Relations Act did is it put the guns away for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, employers used to drop literal bombs on their striking workers, you know, in the 19th century.
Well, I grew up in the 1950s for the most part, and unions, I have to point out or bring up, when I was a kid, unions were linked overly simplistically, but rather effectively, with Jimmy Hoffa and corruption. Unions got a bad name. Any guess as to how much that image may have hurt nationwide support for unionism?
I mean, it hurt. I mean, it hurt in terms of a media narrative. It was definitely signal noise. But what really attacked the unions is when employers weaponized this 1938 Supreme Court decision, this really stupid Supreme Court decision that had this offhand line about, you know, of course an employer is allowed to continue and protect his business so that if workers go on strike, you know, the law says that there should be no retaliation for going on strike. So the law actually says if you go on strike, you're allowed to go back to your job. But this little throwaway line in a Supreme Court decision said that, well, if it's necessary to protect and continue your business, you know, you can hire people to permanently replace your striking workers as long as you're not doing it on a discriminatory basis. If you replace people by seniority, I guess it's legal. Throwaway line, not used at all for 50 years. After Reagan fires the air traffic controllers, you know, we think of that as being the signal moment of this assault on unions. And it was symbolic. So you got the sort of the Jimmy Hoffa stuff, and then you've got Reagan firing the air traffic controllers. But what happened is a copper mining company in Arizona called Phelps Dodge took that old Supreme Court decision. They bargained their workers to impasse over draconian cuts in wages, benefits, and working conditions. So the workers had to go on strike. They bust in hundreds and thousands of scabs, and they kept the scabs on the job for 12 months. So that at the end of the 12 months, the scabs were able to conduct a decertification election and vote the union out, and all of the striking workers lost their jobs. And then that became the blueprint. And all kinds of unionized companies spent the 1980s doing that, and that's where union density started to decline, and that's where people started to get scared of forming a union. And that's where, one of the things that is a standard management line when workers are trying to form a union is, you know, you're not going to get anything unless you go on strike. And if you go on strike, you'll lose your job. And there's a lot of truth to that statement. Now, that's changing a lot, because I think that the working class, we have our backs against the wall to such an extent that, you know, what do you got to lose? You know, you go on strike at Wendy's, you know, oh, you're going to fire me from Wendy's? I'll go to McDonald's. It's the same crappy conditions, you know. And so you're seeing a lot more of a fight back. But that permanent replacement of striking workers was really the damaging thing. That plus the fact that, you know, employers seceded from the system, subcontracting, offshoring, and freelancing makes it impossible to form a union. Under those circumstances, you can't form a union and get to the employer who's the real decision maker. As a union organizer, I would say in easily one third of the campaigns that I did, at some point management would subcontract some segment of the bargaining unit just to throw some signal noise in, just to show the futility of organizing. That, you know, well, we formed a union and we lost our jobs. You know, now now we have to work for this subcontractor, and the law lets them do that, and so it's a completely broken system.
Wow, it certainly presents opportunities as well. I mean, and in the title of the book that we're talking about here is Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Our guest is the author, Sean Richman. And talking a little bit about history, it's labor history is amazing in America, and elsewhere too, but the late 19th century in America is referred to as the Gilded Age. That's when unions really started to gain strength. And of course, we have something very similar now. It's probably even more of a Gilded Age, where there's just very few people with an unbelievable amount of money, and then there's everybody else. What was happening back then when unions started to happen? What was happening then and now that calls for union organizing?
Well, I mean, unions weren't successfully organizing during the Gilded Age. They were losing.
No. Yes.
They were fighting tremendous fights. I mean, that's a massive, massive strikes. But all that money being on the other side meant that, you know, the judges were enjoining those strikes, you know, and governors and presidents were calling out the National Guard to shoot the striking workers.
Yeah.
it was only, you know, it's sort of the progressive era. Right. When enough people in positions of responsibility sort of recognized that this was inherently an unstable and potentially revolutionary situation,
yes,
that they had to start changing the rules and making some more pro-worker laws, that you really started to see a change. And I think we're there, although, I mean, you know, I mean, where are we in our democracy right now?
Mm.
We're in a very scary moment. I mean, you know. If, you know, if we have a new president, if we have a new Democratic president, if we have a Democratic Senate, I do think you have enough. You have sort of the conditions now where there are some key leaders, there are some key advisors who recognize that there have to be some radical changes that are made very quickly, or else the Democrats are never going to get out of this cycle of you have 2 years where you have, you know, the Congress and the presidency. But then you lose the midterm,
right,
and the Republicans come in and do more damage. You know, nobody's happy. it's a mess. You gotta get in there and you gotta put some money in workers' pockets right away. You gotta pass some pro-worker laws so that we can get you know union membership. You can get millions of new union members very quickly, so that you've actually got more of a get out the vote machine, so you can win re-election. I think that there's enough people that get that. Certainly Elizabeth Warren gets that, and
yeah,
you know, she's a key senator. Certainly Bernie Sanders gets that, and he's
yeah,
a key senator. So the conditions are potentially there.
Well, talk about conditions. Boy, we are in quite a place now, not only with the crazy dictator wannabe orange one Trump, but the COVID-19 health crisis and the ensuing economic meltdown. As you say, it still sees those naive optimists who think there is some semblance of the old normal that we can return
yeah,
to when the pandemic yeah, is finally behind us, end of quote, of the broken healthcare system. You're right. Most unions negotiate with employers individually, and the rising cost of insurance premiums drags down wages and the ability to organize new shops. And you go on to say, my experience as an organizer and a negotiator has convinced me that unions cannot grow until we kick the boss out of the doctor's office. Boy, I agree with that. It's, you know, to me, it's long seemed crazy to link medical insurance with employment. Listeners might be interested to learn from you when and why this arrangement came to be.
Yeah, it's because of the unions, and it was a 5-year compromise on a 10-year problem. So it starts because during World War II, there was a wage freeze, and that was a real problem for unions because you know, inflation was still going up, prices were going up. Workers were very restive. You know, they wanted their wages to keep track with prices. And unions were trying to not go on strike because, you know, we were trying to beat the Nazis and we needed production to keep going.
Seems reasonable,
And so the labor board at the time, the war labor board, came up with a thing called the Little Steel Formula that basically said, okay, we can't let wages go up, but we won't count fringe benefits as wages. You had a lot of unions that negotiated for, you know, okay, what can we get? They started looking around. They said, oh, let's get health insurance. and health insurance was cheap at the time. Yeah. And so what you had is a lot of the American Federation of Labor Unions got into the healthcare business, and a lot of came away, you know, by 1946, where workers were getting their health care from the job thanks to their union contract. Now, we had two labor federations at the time. We had the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which had a more social democratic orientation. And their vision for society was, you know, let's get back and let's expand the Social Security Administration so that we get health care from Social Security. We get it as a right as citizens.
What a concept.
Huh. But, you know, the Republicans won the midterm elections in 1946, and then, you know, the Republicans won the White House in 1952, and it was very clear that you just weren't going to get it with a Republican president. So that's a 10-year problem that I'm referring to.
Yeah.
And so the CIO unions go into bargaining in 1952, 1953, basically saying, well you know, we got to get something because our members need to go to the doctor. Sure. And so, you know, the United Auto Workers win it in this big contract with General Motors that's referred to in history as the Treaty of Detroit, the 5-year contract, and provides pensions and health care. And that's when all unions start bargaining for health care and winning it. And because you had union density at around 33%, the non-union companies had to match the benefits. And so you had this period of time of 30, 40 years where, you know, it was more or less working. And it sort of just sort of became like this weird American exception to the rest of the world. You know, we get our health insurance, we get our health care from the employment, and it's fine. It mostly works. If you can ignore those 28 million people that don't have health insurance, it mostly works. But it's broken now, and there's no way that we can bootstrap our way back to 33% and force all these other employers to start raising their standards. And the additional problem that we have now is, you know, to a boss, you are a line on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And you're a more expensive line than you see in your paycheck. So, you know, when salary is, you know, wages plus 33-35%, to go from being a non-union employer that is basically not providing any health insurance to being a unionized employer that you know, the workers want a 10% wage increase and health care. It does actually make a company less competitive,
right.
And so it makes employers fight even harder. On top of that, you know, for unions that are, you know, legacy unions where you have a contract, most, you know, you come to the table on day one to bargain a successor agreement, and the company is putting concessions right on the table. They're like, look, premium's got to go up. You know, we're paying too much. You got to share this. So you're already fighting concessions on day one when what you really want to do is raise wages and, you know, get paid family leave and all this other stuff. So we're trapped in it. We're totally trapped in it. And I mean, I think there's a bit of a divide within the labor movement that unions, that public sector unions, and unions that represent smaller employers and negotiate on an individual basis sort of get it. But you have unions that have labor management plans, you know, multi-employer bargaining and multi-employer health benefit plans, and particularly unions like one that I worked for in New York, the Hotel Trades Council, that because they run their own health benefits, they also run their own healthcare clinics. Where it becomes a real source of power. It's excellent healthcare, first of all. It's the best healthcare I had in my life when I worked for the Hotel Trades Council. But it's real power because they run it, and they pay the doctors themselves. The doctors are on salary, and the health equipment is on salary. They don't face quite the same medical inflation, so they can provide excellent healthcare at a lower than market rate. So it actually, for a union like that, when the hotel workers come for one of the rare non-union hotels that are left in New York City, or they've expanded into New Jersey, it's actually this benefit that they can bring to the table that you know, once they can get the boss to sit down with them, they can explain, like, we're actually going to save you 10% on your health care. We want that to get rolled over into wages, but, you know, there's a win-win here. So the unions that have that are few and far between. They're largely in the building trades. It's the two big locals of the hotel employees. There's a few others that have it. They wind up having this very outsized role in the debate on the issue because they see it as they do potentially have something to lose. But you know, a lot of other unions, they're losing constantly by having to bargain over health insurance, where it's a constant fight against concessions.
Well, yeah, concessions. They used to do that quite a bit, but anyway, it still does happen sometimes. And how often does it happen that employers are in a position of strength and push more and more of the cost of insurance onto employees? Is that still going on?
I don't think there's a round of bargaining at any union in any contract where the employer does not try to get concessions on health care.
Mm.
And at this point, it's not even, you know, an ability to pay thing. It's, everybody else is getting it. All of my competitors are getting it. I want it too.
Uh-huh.
It's a power move, you know?
Yeah. It'd be nice to have the people who are most affected have some ability to participate in it. And I mentioned earlier the COVID-19 health crisis. You know, it's the air has been cleaned up. That's one of the positives of it. There's not a lot. There's a lot of clinical depression in the United States these days among a lot of people. But, you know, a lot of people are hoping, just go back to the old normal. That, you know, once the pandemic is behind us, go back to the old normal. What opportunities do you think there may be now? I mean, the COVID-19 is just shaking up everything. What opportunities might that present?
Well, I mean, you know, striking. I mean, you know, I've been joking in a lot of these interviews that I can't wait till we all get back to work so we can all go on strike right away. And so I wrote the book obviously before COVID. And you know, in 2019, you know, we saw a notable uptick in strikes. In 2018 and 2019, we saw a real increase in strikes. In fact, 2019 was the high watermark for strikes in the 21st century. And in my book, I try to throw a little bit of cold water on that. I mean, it's encouraging. Because one of our problems is how do you get workers to go on strike if they don't have models of how to go on strike, if they don't see other workers go on strike and win? And so, you know, striking is contagious, but the contagion can run both ways. You know, in the era of Phelps-Dodge and the post-Patco era of the 1980s, you saw a tremendous decline in strikes because workers saw strikes as a losing strategy. So, you know, and there's a lot of people that were excited by the return of strikes in 2019, and so it's referred to as a strike wave, and it's not a strike wave. Mm-hmm. All we did is we got back to 1986 levels of strikes, and 1986 was a really lousy year for strikes. But it was growing. Now, you know, in this current moment, what's frustrating to me is it's hard to know what's happening out there. Because we can't, you know, I mean, a really successful union is about getting face to face, getting in people's faces, getting in each other's faces, getting in the boss's face, and we can't do that. And you know, journalists are getting laid off left and right, so it's hard, you know. So you've got a lot of anecdotal stuff about these wildcat strikes at McDonald's stores, you know, at Amazon fulfillment centers, where people's lives are on the line, and so they are doing what should come natural, which is they're protesting at the point of employment. They're saying, "I'm not going to continue to work if this is an unsafe condition for me." I think it's happened a lot. I think we are actually in a strike wave right now, a very historic strike wave, but it's impossible to quantify. And so, you know, what happens when we get back? I don't know. My fear is that the people who have just learned how to strike are not going to have jobs when the pandemic is over because we'll be in a Great Depression.
Yeah.
But they've all learned something about the power of uniting with their coworkers and going on strike, and that is also contagious. And that's really where our power is going to come from. You know, we're not going to get anything, you know, I was saying about the conditions of, you know, within the Democratic Party that some people get it. Yes, some people get it. You know, I'm not terribly enthusiastic about the prospects of a Joe Biden candidacy.
I understand.
He's going to need workers going on strike to force him to do the things that we need to do. And I hope that we're learning how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, he was not my top choice here in the New Hampshire primary, but it is what it is, and it's either him or Trump. And, you know, we're not going to get anywhere at all. I mean, he'll just put up you know, it'd be just, you can't have Trump again. You just can't have Trump again.
Well, I mean, Trump is an existential threat to unions and to democracy.
And to democracy, absolutely. Absolutely. And one of my favorite presidents, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was a traitor to his class, I understand, but good for him. He was a big supporter of collective bargaining rights. Our current union system, I believe, was born during his New Deal. We need another New Deal. Through the National Industrial Recovery Act. Though, as you say, not worth the paper it was printed on. You observe it meant just enough to the workers of 1933 to mean something. What did it mean, and why is it not so valuable today?
Well, so, I think there's more here to our history. I mean, I think we're all sort of drawing on the 1930s for our hope of what comes next.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things, you got to break it down in sort of a day-by-day, you know, month-by-month thing. Because I would have hated Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. I would have hated Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 and 1934, to be frank with you.
Hmm.
That his approach to fixing the economy was not a pro-worker approach. It was a pro-corporate approach. He was trying to get corporations to collude over prices. and in the context of doing that, he threw unions a bone.
Uh-huh.
Because it was so hard to get through. Any ability to get less opposition was what he needed. So the National Industrial Recovery Act, it would create these boards that would create codes across an industry. Again, primarily it was to get employers to collude over prices. But the price of labor is a part of that.
Yes.
And so unions were sort of dealt in that there would also be a labor code. And so within that act, you know, unions are saying, yeah, but, you know, they're shooting us. You know, we need some protections here. It says, okay, well, you have a right to organize. You have a right to organize a union. There's no enforcement mechanism for that right. But it was just enough to raise workers' hopes that it actually did get workers organizing. Just the signal of the federal government's got your back. Go ahead and organize, got workers organizing. Employers resisted like hell, and they formed company unions, and they continued to shoot striking workers, and there needed to be some teeth that were put into it. And this is the thing there's a couple of things that are forgotten in history here. One, first of all, National Industrial Recovery Act lasts about a year and a half. It's found to be unconstitutional.
Okay.
Because the Supreme Court was totally opposed to this sort of government intervention in the economy.
Right.
The National Labor Relations Act was being drafted while the National Industrial Recovery Act was still in existence. It was being drafted to be the enforcement mechanism of Section 7A of the right to organize. It was not being drafted to be our main labor law. It was meant to work alongside these sort of industrial boards. Which is why I suggest that maybe going back to sort of the industrial board model and having the NLRA exist side by side with it is a thing from history that we should revisit. But again, Section 7A was enough to get to inspire workers to organize. They started organizing. Then they got the National Labor Relations Act. There was some enforcement to it, and we wouldn't have gotten to the sit down strikes without that. But the other thing here is sort of key that, you know, there's a version of history that we on the left, frankly, tell ourselves that is actually disempowering. You know, there's this feeling of, well, we're not going to get labor law change without the general strike, without the strike wave, without the sit down strikes. You know, and so it's almost like, well, why should we even bother thinking about what the labor law reform would be? We should be focused on getting the strike wave going, as if you can't walk and chew bubble gum at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's not entirely true. Section 7A was given to us at a moment when labor was incredibly weak, and it's because we were in a crisis. The Great Depression was a crisis. It was a crisis of not just the economy, but also of democracy.
Yes.
And so, you know, Roosevelt, who was not a friend of labor, it really wasn't until the National Labor Relations Act, and he was coming up for re-election in 1936, that the sort of the labor-liberal New Deal coalition came together. So he sort of bumbled into it, you know, backwards. It was not what he came into office thinking he was going to do. But the crisis was enough to say, okay, we have to do something for the unions. It was also we got the Norris LaGuardia Act. It's a crucial law because you still had judges, you know, from the Gilded Age, enjoining union strike activity, and it was getting impossible for unions to win anything because they would you know get arrested, they would get sued, and they would you know have the National Guard get called out on them. And so what was needed was Congress saying to judges, back off. you have no role to play in a dispute between an employer and an employee. And that actually gets passed and signed in 1932. Hoover signs it because of the crisis. And so what I was trying to argue in this book, and again, I wrote this book before COVID, they're saying we're in a crisis. Clearly, Trump is a crisis. He's not the cause of the crisis. He's a symptom of the crisis.
Right.
That the tremendous inequality is eroding our democracy, and you have enough Democrats who are getting that, that it is possible to get something. Won't be enough, but it might be enough. You know, if it's enough to raise workers' hopes and expectations so that they start taking more action, then it might be enough.
Raising hopes and expectations, that's a good idea, I must say. And, you know, politicians always wait till it's safe. You know, they won't do it with Roosevelt famously told A. Philip Randolph of the Pullman Car Workers Union that he wanted to help with, you know, anti-segregation. And I remember, I don't know the exact quote, but Roosevelt told him,
make me do it.
Exactly.
Which Obama said to the unions about the Employee Free Choice Act, make me do it.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, no kidding. Well, I would prefer, I mean, Obama could have been a lot better on a lot of things, but he was sane. It was, you know,
yeah.
He knew what he was doing. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, the show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about a key part of democracy, that's workers' ability to organize. And we're talking with Sean Richmond, who's got a brand new book out called Tell the Bosses We're Coming, and it's got a great megaphone cover there, and it says a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. And a little bit more in history, right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, you know, when we had to all unite, both the AFL and the CIO pledged not to strike for the duration of the war. Apparently that was a turning point for the labor unions. In what way?
Yeah, it was a turning point. Yeah, and it goes to this issue of sort of agency fee, you know, which came up in the recent Supreme Court case of Janus, which, you know, looking at politically coerced speech rather than deal with our NLRB elections and the fact that the employer can fire you if you don't subject yourself to a presentation of lies and threats. Where the Supreme Court said, you know, was really trying to make the entire public sector go "quote unquote" right to work, which is,
yes,
you know, that a union that is compelled legally to represent all of the workers in a bargaining unit can't charge a fee to everybody in the bargaining unit. That concept comes out of World War II, and it's because, like I told you, you know, before, the wage freeze comes down. So here are the unions; they're trying to prevent strikes, but there's a wage freeze, and workers are just pissed off. And so the union is out there saying, you know, sorry, we can't get you a wage increase, you know, but you can't go on strike. And you had some wildcat strikes, and you had workers dropping their union dues in protest. And so the unions were saying, look, this is an untenable situation. We can't prevent people from striking if we can't keep them in the membership. And in a lot of cases, it's because the contract actually applied only to union members. So if a member dropped out, then the contract and the no strike clause didn't apply to them. And so the War Labor Board sort of agreed to this principle. Now, it wasn't agency fee. It was something similar to it. It was a maintenance membership, which is basically, okay, on the day that the contract is signed, everybody who's a member has to remain a member. But that evolves into the union shop and to agency fee. And an argument that I was making in the run-up to Janus, to the bosses and to the courts, was basically like, you might regret doing this, because if you start tugging at the thread of agency fee, you're tugging at the thread of a thing that actually works in your favor.
Yeah.
Because exclusive representation and agency fee are what make no-strike clauses possible. And I do think that the no-strike clauses are a major problem for the labor movement. Because in my experience, you know, again, if we want strikes to be contagious and we need workers to see examples of other workers going on strike and winning,
yes,
unions should play a major role in that. And in my experience, union representatives spend a lot of time actually having to shut down wildcat activity by their workers. So when the contract is in effect, the boss does something outrageous and the workers want to do a work slowdown, or they do some sort of protest. And these no-strike clauses are very expansive. It's not just a complete cessation of work that you can't do. It is, you know, a slowdown. It is, you know, a selective refusal to do certain things.
Yeah.
And so the union rep has to be the policeman saying, look, you can't do that. And so I'd like, you know, if we didn't have, if those no strike clauses were unenforceable, I think you'd have a lot more wildcat strike activity, and you'd have a lot more positive examples of workers taking action and inspiring their family members at their jobs and their coworkers, their neighbors to take similar actions. And I think that if you knock out agency fee, you do have the potential there for multiple competing unions in the workplace. Yeah. Which would make no-strike clauses completely unenforceable. And so the employers sort of forget that having that is what they wanted. They won that. There used to be multiple competing unions in workplaces. You know, the boss's favorite number of unions is zero. Let's be clear about that.
Right.
But the second favorite number is one.
Yeah. And I can tell by, you know, what you're saying there that, you know, it's backing up the idea that more people want representation, more workers want to be represented by a union and have a union fighting for them. But and the energy is there in the 21st century. It's just a question of tapping it and learning from history. What a concept, learning from history and seeing what works and to plug it in. And we mentioned a little bit the so-called right to work. As a former state senator, I was inundated with calls every year to pass so-called right-to-work laws, like the movie.
Yeah. I was at AFT. I remember that was a constant in New Hampshire.
Oh, my goodness, yes. It was like Groundhog Day. They never gave up, though they kept losing. 27 states, I understand, now have so-called right-to-work. It's a nice-sounding name, but I wonder, I mean, tell the listeners what they really are, and do we have them on the run? Or if the anti-union forces are gaining on so-called right to work?
Well, I mean, it's in the majority of states now, so we're past a tipping point. Right to work is basically a rule that somebody can be represented by the union, file a grievance, get cost all the money for that, and doesn't have to pay a dime in union dues or fees. And it's a strategy to weaken unions, weaken their bank accounts, and just make them less effective. And the right wing loves to do it. And I think that the labor movement really does need to contend with this issue. Because, you know, if we get to the point where New York, California, Illinois, and New Jersey are the only non-right-to-work states, I don't know how you really continue that much longer.
Mm.
But again, I don't think that an exclusive representation works without agency fee.
Right.
I think that, you know, there's some thought, there's some people in the labor movement who think that we can somehow get back to, you know, we could repeal right to work, which we can. I mean, it's a very easy way to repeal right to work. The only reason that it exists is that it's a carve out in federal law that was created in the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act. This should be a matter of federal policy. It shouldn't be left to the states. But on this one single issue, the act created a carve out that said, well, a state can pass a law about this. And it became this sort of state-by-state thing, and it forced unions into sort of lobbying for it as a special interest. We could amend the National Labor Relations Act, and we could easily just take that language out and immediately. That's actually a thing that I think Joe Biden understands, and he understands that unions want it, and it's entirely possible that bill could get to his desk and he would sign it. But if we can't get back to it, I do think that, you know, and I don't sound like a crazy person. I have very sober thoughts about what this looks like in the book. But I do think that we should be considering experimenting with abandoning exclusive representation, because it just does not work with right to work.
Interesting. Well, I love history and just so much to read. It's amazing to me. And the one thing I've learned from history is that we never learn from history. But as a fan of the old industrial workers of the world, one big union, the Wobblies, I'm intrigued that, unless I read it wrong, you champion the idea that regardless of who we are, where or how much we work, we should be all in and represented by some industrial labor board. What would that look like? How would it work? And does it have any resemblance to the old idea of one big union, IWW?
No, it resembles more sort of the National Industrial Recovery Act, actually. I mean, that's sort of what I'm thinking. That model, again, combined with a National Labor Relations Board that's going to enforce workers' rights and prosecute unfair labor practices. So that if you could have side, so you have a labor code across industry. So let's imagine hospitality.
Sure.
You know, you could have a labor code that bans tipping, you know, and raises the minimum wage for all wait staff.
Yes.
And that'd be great.
Yeah,
know.
It would. Go ahead.
Or you could have a labor code that comes up with language that says, you know, basically says, you know, you can't force your waitresses to wear sexually exploitive uniforms. And then you can have within that, you know, whatever percentage of restaurants have a union and have a labor contract, you know, that is bargaining above and beyond that code. Or I also play with the idea of telecommunications, where you basically have three phone companies, you know, so it's kind of easy, you know, in terms of cell phones. You know, Verizon is the unionized company where there's a contract.
Yes.
But if you had an industrial board that could set codes, then you could, you know, then the union would have this sort of ability to sort of, you know, leapfrog the contract at Verizon with a labor code. You know, maybe win it in the Verizon contract and then take it to the labor code, maybe take it to the labor code, win it there, get it in the contract.
Uh-huh.
And while they're bargaining at Verizon, you know, in cell phones, you know, AT&T is the unionized one, Verizon is the non-union one. Well, uh-huh. You know, if you have an issue coming up at the industrial labor board, your read on it would be that Verizon as the wireless carrier is the big bad guy. And because you don't have a contract, you don't have a no strike clause. That's the one that you're doing a deeper dig in, and you're trying to get rolling protests and strikes in order to win something at the labor board. And maybe at some point you get to the point where Verizon's like, you know what, we want to get in on this sweet no strike action. Let's talk about a neutrality agreement for a contract. But again, it's sort of workplace government that you know, for hospitality in particular, it's going to be very hard to get a union contract in every restaurant in America. But if you're working, you know, at a restaurant in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, it's good to know that industrial board, that labor code, is going to apply to you.
Uh-huh.
You know, and if it does apply to you, then you know that there are a number of unions, you know, that you could join that are saying to you, look,
right.
We need your support. Sign this card, pay dues, wear this button, sign this petition. We got to put pressure on that board, join the union. And you start to separate union membership from the high stakes, was there a vote at your workplace years ago? There's a real value to joining the union right now because at that industrial board level, rules could get passed that could apply to you, and you need a strong union advocating for you, and you need to be a part of that strong union. And if we had that, then you get much closer to 60% of all workers that want to be in a union being in a union.
That's a good idea. And was that in you wrote something in 2016, the Labor's Bill of Rights? What do you hope that might achieve?
So in Labor's Bill of Rights, I sort of lay out a number of ways that if you step back, like I described the National Labor Relations Board certification elections, where you step back, it's just the full weight of the labor law regime is rather plainly unconstitutional. But we don't make those arguments. And partly it's a very cautious strategy that union lawyers tend to have. Because there's real risk to taking cases to the courts, because you know the courts are packed with hostile right-wing judges.
Absolutely,
right now.
Yes.
But I think that by not taking those cases, that's just a strategy for you losing less quickly. I think we need to roll the dice on a few things and to win. So I basically there's a number of areas that I outline where I said we should be making arguments that aspects of the law are violating our First Amendment rights, our Fifth Amendment rights, our Tenth Amendment rights, our Thirteenth Amendment rights, our Fourteenth Amendment rights, and take those cases by strategically lodging cases at the National Labor Relations Board or in the courts, and in some cases by breaking the law. There's lots of aspects of the law that really, really restrain unions in ways that no corporation would. You know, the Taft-Hartley Act bans solidarity. I mean, that's its biggest damage, right? A few years back, Nabisco shipped its Oreo factory out of Chicago to Mexico, a unionized Oreo factory. You know, what would make sense is if unionized supermarket workers around the country said, "Well, we're not gonna put scab Oreos on the shelves. You know, we're not gonna unload that truck." It would be completely illegal for them to do that. Not only would it be completely illegal, the company would have has the ability to sue them for triple the economic damages. And of course, the company would claim that they're losing billions. No union could survive that. But again, you know, corporations are not subject to those kinds of rules. How many times are you watching the TV and you get a message from your cable company, you know, saying, you know, call this CEO or else, you know, you might not be able to watch, you know, basketball, right? Because the cable company is in a fight with the cable channel over how much they're going to charge, and you, the third party, are in the middle of it. Perfectly legal for corporations to do, totally illegal for unions to do. That I would say is a equal protection under the law case, and we should make it.
Well, you talk about, you know, the law and the various amendments. There's the Commerce Clause, which I guess you know, the National Labor Relations Act is grounded on. But should it be, you suggest it be grounded on the law, the 13th Amendment that bans slavery? Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so I mean, and the American Federation of Labor wanted it to be based on the 13th Amendment, you know, when this was being drafted in 1935. The reason the law gets rooted in the Commerce Clause is that you had a Supreme Court that was overturning every piece of New Deal legislation because they didn't think the government belonged in the private market. And so, you know, the feeling was amongst sort of progressive legislators, well, you know, the Constitution explicitly says Congress can regulate commerce between the states.
Right.
So let's use that and let's tell the courts this is why this law is constitutional. Back off. It was a smart but very cautious and limited strategy. And, you know, look, the National Labor Relations Act was ultimately found to be constitutional, and the Supreme Court weighed heavily on the Commerce Clause portion of it. But the political reality is that the Supreme Court ruled the National Labor Relations Act constitutional because there's a wave of strikes going on, and there were sit-down strikes, and they saw all the they saw the NLRB as a way of regulating this and of bringing industrial peace. So it might have been found constitutional anyway, and we'd be better off if it was rooted in, you know, our Bill of Rights and our Reconstruction Amendment rights, rather than this narrow technocratic thing. Because the problem the problem became, okay, the law was constitutional, but then employers kept, you know, employers immediately turned around and said, hey, we have rights too. And the reason that they get to do these captive audience meetings, you know, which is the way they conduct the NLRB certification elections, is they went to the Supreme Court and they said, look, we have a First Amendment right to express our opinion. Because the National Labor Relations Act was written to the intention was that employers could not speak out against the union. Employers just had to, it was up to the workers themselves, and the employers had no role in it. And the employers said, no, we have a First Amendment right, you know, let us. And they went on that. And the problem for unions now, ever since, is that the employer goes to the court and they say, look, we have First Amendment rights, we have property rights. And we're going to court saying, like, look, you know, the act is constitutional because of the Commerce Clause. We're not there saying, hey, we have First Amendment rights, too. We have 13th Amendment rights, too. And under that frame, we lose. And particularly in this era of the weaponized First Amendment, you know, which was used to in the Janus case, commerce is no match for the weaponized First Amendment. So in Labor's Bill of Rights, I'm saying we should be arguing that the law is unjust by pointing to our constitutional rights. But also, you know, in the book, I'm talking about, well, if we do wind up fixing the National Labor Relations Act, that's one of the primary things that we got to fix. We have to fix the preamble, and we have to make it a more active assertion of workers' constitutional rights. Because otherwise, you could get a good law, but the courts are going to dilute it over the course of the decades that follow.
And one of the things, there are lawsuits that often slow down, legislative actions. You believe that the filing of a lot of unfair labor practice claims is a central means of reestablishing labor. Tell us about that, please.
Well, so Yeah, I mean, if we were to be doing a Labor's Bill of Rights type strategy, right? So take the NLRB elections. I hope there are local union presidents listening to this that might be open to this. The next time that an election is scheduled and an employer forces a mandatory captive audience meeting, I think a union should file an unfair labor practice charge mm-hmm. against them. And file it even though we think the NLRB would reject it and say, no, they're allowed to do that. Just keep filing them. And what we're trying to get is sure. a ruling from the National Labor Relations Board once we have, a majority of Democratic appointees again, a ruling that says, actually, you are right. This does look like a violation of the First Amendment, and we're going to say that they can't do that. Or what we could do is, and this gets forgotten, so the bosses win the First Amendment right to do captive audience meetings. For a while, the NLRB applied an equal time standard that said, well, if they're going to do captive audience meetings, then you also have to give the union access to the voters. You have to let them be on the physical property and meet with workers in non-work locations in non-work times.
Seems fair.
It seems fair.
Yeah.
The NLRB can restore that rule at any time. And what kills me is that actually the NLRB is on record since 1966 as saying, hey, let us know if you want us to revisit that rule. I mean, we just sort of forgot. I mean, this is really a bad thing about the labor movement is we're such an oral tradition that it's just got forgotten.
Yeah.
So we should go back there. We should definitely ask for that. Because if we win it, well, then the employers are going to go, to the Supreme, to the courts and say, this is a violation of our property rights. And then we would be there arguing, yes, but we have First Amendment rights. And by the way, this whole way that this is run is a violation of the First Amendment. And then, we're off to the races with a First Amendment labor case in the courts, one that, I think we might win just because the facts of the situation are so egregious. It's so hard to defend.
Well, one last question. Theoretically, there will be an election in November. Who the heck knows?
Theoretically.
Might Joe Biden be better for organized labor than Obama was?
A Democratic president will be better than Trump is for sure.
Yeah.
And the next Democratic president will be better than Obama was, just like Obama was better than Bill Clinton was. Because I think that there's enough policymakers and electeds in the Democratic camp who recognize that the attacks on unions are attacks on their get out the vote operation. So the attacks on unions are actually an existential threat to the Democratic Party.
Yes, they are for sure. Well, we've come to the end of the hour. Thank you so much. The book is called Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Sean Richman, it's put out by the Monthly Review Press. Thank you so much for being with us. Very informative.
There once was a union maid who never was afraid. But the goons and the geeks and the company finks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. And when the news was called, she went to the union hall. And when the Legion boys came round, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union, till the day I die.
Yeah.
This union maid was wise to the tricks of company spies. She couldn't be fooled by the company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way when she struck for better pay. She'd show her card to the National Guard, and this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
You women who wanna be free, just take a tip from me. Join your hand with a union man into the 21st century. As Angela Davis found, we're all together bound. Let race and class and gender join to stand on common ground.
Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking with the union. I'm sticking to the union.